This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Welcome to another so special Out to Coop Extra. Today we've got something extra special for you. I am sitting here with Colleen Bradley and Dan Kearney, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about a whistleblower case that can have, may have, just may have national implications in terms about whistleblower rights. So Colleen, Dan, welcome. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, Kevin, for having us.
Good morning, Kevin.
So I just want to give everyone a little kind of background here. For those of you who are sick and tired of hearing me talk about budgets and the activity, the sketchy financial activity of the state system of higher education and the budgeting practices in this state, well, okay, you might want to kind of sit back and relax a little bit because I'm going to force you to listen to it anyways, right? So if you remember, years ago, back in 2011, when I first started Raging Chicken Press, one of the first articles I ever wrote on was about this these budgeting schemes that were taking place at Kutztown University and the state system of higher education that was basically pointing toward the way towards the manipulation of budgets to make it seem as if the sky was falling in the entire state system of higher education, when in reality, we find out later, of course, that the sky was not falling. It was falling only on the kind of the budgets that were being presented to faculty and state legislators, right? And those funds were basically and those budgets were kind of, you know, showing that there was no money. So what are you going to do? You have to cut faculty, you have to cut programs, and then you have to, you know, cry poverty to the state legislator and demand more appropriations. Well, back in 2014, if you recall, we followed this case then. Colleen Bradley, who worked at Westchester University at the time, and Colleen, you were the director
of budget and financial planning.
Director of budget and financial planning at Westchester University. Colleen Bradley was fired, right? She was fired from Westchester University because she wanted to present the actual financial situation of Westchester University and other posh universities, by extension, as opposed to a budget that was basically purposely manipulated to show that the sky was falling when, in fact, the university and other posh universities, too, were flush with funds. So this is kind of where we stand right now. And so Colleen Bradley was fired, and then she went forward and filed a whistleblower lawsuit, claiming that her First Amendment rights had been violated, that she was being punished for basically telling the truth to decision makers at the university, for going above and beyond what she was supposed to be doing in her job, but actually trying to serve us, right, in the public, right, other constituents, other stakeholders for state system of higher education of Westchester University, by presenting us the truth so we can actually have a transparent conversation about the needs of public higher education in this state. So I'll admit right from the get-go, I'm a little worked up about this one, folks. A little bit worked up about this one because it hits home. And every time I hear this story, I am so outraged that fact number one, that telling the truth and attempting to kind of represent financial situations of universities accurately gets you canned, right? Number one. But number two, that there have been no consequences for the fraud that has been perpetrated on really everyone in the state of Pennsylvania, right? And some of the very people who perpetrated that fraud are now sitting in the president's office at Westchester University, right? So this is kind of where we stand. So I'll end my little diatribe here. So I want to say, so Colleen, first to you, just, I mean, what's this experience been like?
Kevin, this experience is beyond what anybody could possibly conceive based upon the amount of evidence that we have that shows that I truly attempted to work within the system. And someone who has a lot of financial expertise, I was able to communicate the games that were taking place at Westchester, and basically had all leadership agreeing that it was not correct to be reporting deficits to the state university as well as to the faculty, and yet it continued. And bottom line is I lost my job. And The saddest thing about it, from my standpoint, is you work your whole career and you don't ask for anything, and unless it's earned. And in my position, I happen to walk into a very, very bad place, and there wasn't anybody that I could turn to align with me. And yet, I had senior leaderships, I had peers, I had colleagues all agree it was wrong, but because they had the freedom to choose not to do anything, and yet it was my name on the report and my name on all of these things, and because of the person who I am, I could not carry and execute out what was being asked of me, and thus have basically lost my career and have been set back. I can't tell you how much mentally, physically, and emotionally. It's very disappointing.
It's incredible. So let's underscore the facts here, right? Some of the facts that you were told, right, by Pashi officials in Harrisburg, to basically change the budget, right, to show that you were having deficits, as opposed to an $18.1 million surplus at the university. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And everyone at – or not everyone, but decision makers, your bosses, the president of the university at that time, they also knew that this was the practice.
That's correct. I brought it to their attention not only verbally, but I brought the reports to Administrative Budget Committee, which consisted of all the senior leadership and as well as colleagues, and they were fully aware of what was being asked of, I say, the committee. And the committee chose to report the deficit in order to keep appropriation funding.
And when you brought to their attention, what did they say to you?
Oh, they totally said it was wrong.
And they say it's wrong, and you say it's wrong, and then but they still want you to go ahead and do this?
Well, yes, because they basically took it to the president, and the president did not want to lose appropriation funding. So basically, my boss submitted the change in the number, which created the deficit, and submitted the report under my name.
It's unbelievable. So in the end, or after about kind of a little over 2 years, I guess, right? A little over 2 years, you continued to attempt to represent the budget figures accurately, what the financial situation of the university is, and eventually what that did, your thanks for doing that was to get fired for speaking out.
That's correct.
So that kind of brings us up. That's the very baseline. I just wanted to kind of say to everybody, too, as well, that this is going to be a story that we are going to be bringing to you in the pages of Raging Chicken Press. We are doing a series of interviews about this case, so we're going to be following up on that. But there's your baseline connections. You go to the links in the description of the show today. We're going to link back to the Colleen Bradley case and the article that I wrote about it then, just to get up to speed on that. What I want to kind of emphasize today is that Colleen now has filed suit as a whistleblower suit, really, because there's been a violation of First Amendment rights. She spoke out and she was fired for doing that. And now it's making its way through the court system. And you'd think that we'd finally get to the point where we're giving justice, but doesn't seem like we're on that track at this point. So, Dan, let me turn to you. So for you, you kind of enter this, right, from this. And Dan is one of Colleen's lawyers, right? And you enter this as someone who's going to be consulting with Colleen about what she can do and start representing her and part of this whistleblower suit. So what was your take on this from the beginning?
From the outset, we thought that the case was really unusual in the sense that Colleen had done a very good job of documenting what had transpired here. So In assessing the case, we had a very, very optimistic view of how the courts would view the case, primarily because we weren't dealing with a he said, she said sort of situation.
Right, right.
We had black and white paper trail of emails, other correspondence, memorandums, which really set forth in a very clear way, factually, what had happened here.
Well, it was. I remember when you first filed the paperwork, and again, in kind of the reporting that I had done on this too as well, what was remarkable about it, every claim that was made, every claim that Colleen had made was backed up there. Here's the email from these people, right?
Yes.
So this
yes.
was not just like someone told me this and I want you to take my word for it. We had the documented evidence of people, of her being told these things.
Yes, and from numerous supervisors at Colleen's University, from senior administrators at PASHI. These were well-documented facts about what had actually transpired here, and what had transpired here very clearly was that Colleen was being asked to falsify budgets that were being submitted to the state of Pennsylvania for tax appropriation purposes. So in that respect, our confidence level around the case was high.
So this is basically a slam dunk. Someone you asked to falsify documents, right? You refuse to do this. You tell people about it. Clear case, right? Open and shut case, right?
Right.
Except that.
when it comes to whistleblower claims, mm-hmm. and one of the decisions that had to be made in the case on the front end was, do you pursue a Pennsylvania state law whistleblower claim? Well, the answer to that question is yes, you do. Do you also pursue a First Amendment claim? And interestingly, I think in Colleen's case, the First Amendment violation to us represented a bit of a hurdle because Colleen, interestingly, took the least disruptive path in terms of speaking out against the misrepresentations that she was being asked to make in her budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than go to the Philadelphia Inquirer, Colleen took her complaints up the chain of command. She went to her supervisor first, didn't get relief there. She went to senior administrators at PASHI, did not get relief there. She went to internal committees, the Administrative Budget Committee. And while she would receive support in meetings and in those in complaining at those meetings for what she was alleging, and that was, you know, blatant misrepresentation in the budgets, nothing ever changed. Nothing ever changed.
So basically, she did what you should do.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
yes.
So basically, she – I mean, this is something when I'm talking with different organizations and activist groups or things like this, is that one of the things you always want to make sure that you do is that you don't kind of jump from zero to 100, right? Go
yes.
from here to the most extreme result. What you want to do is you want to tick all your boxes along the way so you can say, look, I exhausted all my options here.
Exactly.
Right? I mean,
exactly.
So in that case, she did exactly what you would expect somebody to do who takes her job seriously. Right, and is committed to accuracy representation, right?
Yes, and from a First Amendment perspective, there's a famous United States Supreme Court decision that lawyers that practice in this area will know is Pickering, and there's a famous Pickering balancing test. And in constitutional law cases, there's typically a balance that happens, and here the Pickering balance commanded that you would consider the public's interest in hearing the speech, and in this case it was extremely high because what Colleen was asserting was misappropriation, impropriety by government officials. And under the Supreme Court precedent, that level of government corruption is entitled to what's called the highest rung or highest
right.
level of First Amendment protection. Now, in the constitutional balancing that happens, they weigh the public's interest, which in this case was very high because we're talking about misappropriation of taxpayer dollars, against the government's interest in efficiently running operations. So, in Colleen's case, as a whistleblower, she was faced with a choice. She
Right.
could go public. She could go to the Philadelphia Inquirer and lay out what happened. And ironically, the way this case is shaping up, Colleen would have likely received more protection had she done that. When what she actually did, consistent with Pickering, she chose the less disruptive path by taking it through the internal channels to get relief, mm-hmm. and that never happened here. So,
so in some ways, right? So if she were to went straight to the papers at that point,
yes.
right? It would have been extraordinarily disruptive.
Yes.
Right. It could have potentially put the university in like a PR spin.
Yes.
Right. But then there also would have been a whole different personal cost to Colleen. Right. Because then it would have been, oh, like, why is she doing this? Why is she going right to the papers? Why wouldn't she go up the chain of command? This is the inappropriate venue. Right.
Right.
It seems like a complete double bind situation.
Yes. And the frustrating part of that is, as the whistleblower, an employee that's in that situation. And this case is also unique in the sense that not only did Colleen become aware of impropriety in government, but she was actually being asked to participate in it, right? So she was the fall person that was being asked to make these misrepresentations in these appropriation budgets, right? So a whistleblower in that position, when they're thinking about going public to a newspaper, has to be concerned about violating confidentiality agreements and things like that. So it's not a very easy choice. And in many of these cases, for those who follow whistleblower cases, you're going to see employees that get terminated for making that call to the newspaper.
Right.
In fact, there's a case in the Third Circuit here called Dougherty, where the plaintiff actually did that and was terminated. Now, Dougherty reaches a result that says Dougherty was entitled to First Amendment protection. Dougherty was reporting on misappropriation by a senior government official. Dougherty was a senior government official, mm-hmm. which is the case here with Colleen. So coming back to this First Amendment analysis and the Pickering balancing test, if we just had Pickering, Colleen's case would be very strong because she spoke on an issue entitled to the highest level of protection, and she did it in the least disruptive way. Unfortunately, in the aftermath of Pickering, there was a case called Garcetti versus Ceballos. And
When was this?
Garcetti is back in 2006, 2007.
So not that long ago.
No, right. No. And in the Garcetti case, the Supreme Court narrowed the First Amendment rights of whistleblowers. And they did so by taking the Pickering balancing test and narrowing the test to add an additional question, essentially, which is, was the employee, if speech takes place within the workplace, was the employee speaking within the ordinary course of their duties or responsibilities?
Mm-hmm.
And in the Garcetti case, that involved an attorney who made some complaints in a memorandum that his employer had asked him to write. And Garcetti admitted that writing that memorandum was part of his everyday job duties, right? So in looking at that case, the court said because it was part of his job and it was part of what he was commissioned to do on his job, that speech was not entitled to First Amendment protection, even though it might have involved an interest of a public nature. Right?
So in that case, that person then puts that memo forward and that he could be fired. And he's not going to get protection, First Amendment protection for that.
Correct.
Even because they don't like what he said, right?
Yes.
That doesn't matter because he was asked to do this and he produced this. He admits that was part of what he was asked to do.
Yes.
And then he gets fired and there's he might have other complaints, but the First Amendment protection is not going to apply.
Yes.
All
correct.
Right. So that's like kind of like a clarification, right,
yes.
of when you get whistleblower protection.
Yes.
And a narrowing, I would say it.
Yes.
Right?
It was definitely viewed as a blow to the rights of whistleblowers,
mm-hmm.
right? This case is, from a Garcetti standpoint, we've had a level of confidence around the case primarily because this is the counterpoint to Garcetti in the sense that not only was Colleen not asked to speak out on the issue that she spoke about, she was directed not to speak out against it, almost to the point where her supervisor might say she was insubordinate
right.
in speaking out and exposing these misrepresentations and this fraud. So,
And let's be clear, too. So when she's speaking out here, too, as well, this is not just, you know, Colleen, you weren't just kind of speaking out just to your immediate supervisor, right? You're reporting to kind of a broader committee of people that had potential decision-making influence at the university.
Yes. It was out of the really the circle of influence that I ever worked, you know, the group that I ever worked with. So from that standpoint, they were influential leaders, but I was not part of that committee. I was invited to attend the committee just to present the data that I was asked to present.
And they originally wanted you to present the false budget, right? The padded budget that was showing that they had a deficit, the sky is falling budget.
Yes.
Right? And then what it was at issue that, but you brought the actual budget, the
yes,
actual
I brought
financial
the
situation.
The realistic budget that showed, like, based upon actual trends in history, this is more of what our true actual performance is like versus the sky is falling.
And you were told explicitly you are not to present that budget.
That's correct.
All right. So now we're at the slam dunk phase, right? So slam dunk, boom. Clearly not said. Garcetti's out of the picture because she's clearly not operating within her job description. She comes out. She does something in the public interest to make sure that the sky is falling budget is exposed for what it is, a complete farce and lie, right? And so we're done, right?
One would think so.
Right?
One would think so. Well, with this case, we viewed it, there's a more recent decision of the Supreme Court, which a lot of attorneys that practice in this area viewed as a swinging back from Garcetti. It's a Lane decision. It's a 2015 decision where the court found that giving public testimony about work-related matters was not within an employee's ordinary duties and therefore entitled to First Amendment protection, right? So we view this as an opportunity to add further clarification to Garcetti, because Garcetti did not lay out a framework for how do you decide whether the employee is speaking within their job duties, right?
Right.
So that's going to be a question of fact, that, and there are a million different factual circumstances that are going to come up in that context. What's significant about Colleen's case for whistleblowers is her speech in being made in the least disruptive way, taking it up the chain of command, taking it outside of the chain of command internally, but not running to the press, right? This is an opportunity for the court to give more instruction on, in this case, even though Colleen is speaking to a committee within her workplace, there's First Amendment protection. Why? Because she's not speaking within her ordinary job duties. How do we know that?
Yes, that's what I was going exactly
How
to get
do we
to.
Know that? We know that because we took her supervisor's deposition.
This was Mark Mixner.
Yes, and he responded to seven or eight different questions at different times in the deposition. Was it Colleen's job to expose financial misrepresentations? No. Was it Colleen's job to expose unethical practices? No. Was it Colleen's job to engage in the specific speech that she engaged in that is the subject matter of this case? No. So we have the person best suited to comment or give opinion on what Colleen's job duties were, testifying under oath that it was not her job duty to make this speech. So what happens?
So now we have the slam dunk, right?
Yes. We thought after the deposition, this should be pretty clear, right? At the district court level, the district court judge found that there was, in fact, a First Amendment violation, because the district judge was able to differentiate between sometimes speech may happen in a budget and sometimes the underlying principle that's behind what's going in the budget is different from this being a budgetary decision or policy or something like that.
Right.
He recognized that there was fraud in the process and was able to separate that from the fact that the fraud is occurring in a budget over which Colleen has responsibility. Colleen was not speaking out against an arguable budgetary practice.
Right.
the core of Colleen's speech was around fraud, right? And the fact that it happened to take place in a budget should not be pertinent to the First Amendment analysis. The core purpose of her speech was to correct government impropriety.
And we saw this, right? And this is right across, this is all in the evidence of the case too as well, not just in the Mixner deposition,
yes,
but all the email exchanges there, that there was a clear awareness,
yes,
that this was indeed fraudulent.
Yes.
So this was not just her opinion, a difference, mm-hmm, of how we figure out kind of like how we calculate these particular numbers. This was saying, we know this is wrong, but do it anyways.
Yes, yes. So coming back to whistleblowers and First Amendment protection and why this case is so critical to whistleblowers, the Supreme Court, as recently as Lane, when they revisited First Amendment around employment, talked about special value speech. And special value speech are people like Colleen in senior government leadership positions that come to know of impropriety that's happening as a result of their position. So Garcetti and Lane teach that there may be First Amendment protection within the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And the question comes back to, was it part of this person's job to report this kind of speech? So if Colleen was an internal auditor at the university and she came upon fraud that was happening in the budget, clearly that's within her job duties,
right?
District Court recognized that even though this fraud was housed in a budget over which Colleen had responsibility, she wasn't really speaking out against the budgetary practice. She's speaking out against fraud, and she's not an auditor.
Right.
She had no obligation to report on it. In fact, she took a great risk in reporting on the speech because she was concerned by standing up against the speech that she'd be terminated. And guess what? She was, ultimately. So in terms of the importance under the law, we have this special value speech that Colleen came upon because of her job, because she was the director of budgeting. However, that value, that speech, should be entitled to the highest level of protection, and the Supreme Court has instructed that we need to incentivize and protect whistleblowers like Colleen,
right,
to make these kinds of speeches, because it's the public interest in understanding government corruption is happening is so high.
Right, and explicitly, so if everybody's forgotten out there, right, freedom of speech, First Amendment rights, I mean, explicitly is about speaking out with your government, your relationship,
yes,
with your government, right, and kind of you're speaking out with fraud here. So this is kind of clearly best case scenario.
Yes.
Right, and the kind of thing I think that we, like, as citizens, right, you know, the kind of thing that we celebrate in movies and all this kind of stuff, right,
yes,
but these whistleblowers coming forward to basically do right by the rest of us when the rest of us are not in a position that we can even know the fraud is happening.
Yes.
Right, and this is why we have those protections at that level.
Yes, exactly. So why are we in front of the Third Circuit United States Court of Appeals, which is the court right below the United States Supreme Court? Why are we there? We got there because even though the district court found that there was a First Amendment violation, they found that Mr. Mixner was entitled to what's called qualified immunity because the rights that were violated were not clearly established, is the standard. So when we went before the Third Circuit, we were prepared to argue about qualified immunity. And there was also a sovereign immunity 11th Amendment issue in the case, which is also on appeal, involving the entities and their immunity from protection, mm-hmm, here.
This isn't a case where about suing your government, right? I mean, this is about that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, the PASHI and Westchester University are quasi-government,
right,
agencies.
Right, right.
So there's a 11th Amendment immunity issue in the case as well, because we don't think that they were entitled to 11th Amendment immunity either, and that's another issue that's still on appeal.
Still ongoing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the Third Circuit, interestingly, actually reversed the decision of the district court that found there was a First Amendment violation. How did they do that?
Yeah.
Why did they do that? Well, the Third Circuit, in our view, missed the boat here. And they missed it in the sense that they substituted their judgment for Colleen's supervisor's judgment on what her job was. How did they do that? They looked at her job description, and then they characterized her speech in a certain way to say her job description is she's the director of budgeting. She has responsibilities to report to committees. She's reporting numbers to committees, and therefore she's reporting information about the budget within her job duties.
So basically, that sounds, when I hear you tell me that about what they did there, it sounds to me like they abstracted things out of any meaningful context, right? And to try to fit the puzzle back together in a way that suited their opinion. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, I don't want to comment, on what they were thinking. We're puzzled by this because there's another fundamental error that we think occurred here, and that's in the summary judgment standard. We have to keep in mind the context in which this issue came before the Third Circuit, and it came before the Third Circuit on a motion for summary judgment. On motions for summary judgment, the court is obligated to give all inferences, factual inferences, to the non-movement, which non-movement in this case is Colleen. So,
right, and part of that is because, too, as well, you're not before the entire panel of judges, right? You're a smaller panel of judges. You basically want to say, if my understanding is right, say, look, this case is going forward. We've got to give the benefit of the doubt of the person bringing it forward, right, because we might have an interest in justice being done. And if it looks like that the facts of this the case are leaning in this, okay, then we need to open this up for a kind of a broader case if necessary.
Well, this
am I getting that right?
Yeah, well, on summary judgment, what that means – In a legal sense, mm-hmm. is that we're just trying to get the case to a jury. We think there's a factual question here around what were Colleen's ordinary job duties. Was it Colleen's job to report fraud that related to the budget or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question of fact. And we have testimony from her supervisor saying, no, it wasn't part of her normal duties. That's a quote. It wasn't part of her ordinary duties. But we have the court essentially taking away the right to get in front of a jury and have them confirm that determination. The court is looking at her job description, looking at its characterization of her speech as relating to a budget concern as opposed to government fraud.
Right.
Right? So if you change the character of the speech and then you fit that within her formal job description, that's the legal determination that was made, and we think that was wrong. So that is what is driving us to the Supreme Court on, you know, we're going to be filing a petition for writ of certiorari to hope that the Supreme Court will look at this case. And we think it's very, very important because there's a split in the circuits at this point. The Ninth Circuit in California has a very favorable First Amendment decision called Dalia versus Rodriguez,
okay.
in which the whistleblower there spoke inside and outside of his chain of command, and they found that there was a First Amendment violation in that case. I think this Third Circuit case is in direct conflict with that case.
So this sets it up as, okay, look, we have actually two separate interpretations of the law here. This is kind of like one of these situations that's set up for the Supreme Court to make a decision to determination
exactly
about how we rectify these two different applications of the law.
Well, and I think more importantly, it's not just those two circuits. The circuits are all over the place mm-hmm. in how you go about applying the Garcetti standard. And I think because this speech happens within the workplace, it happens where really the misrepresentations that have gone on, like I said when we started the conversation, this is not a he said, she said
right.
case. It's black and white what happened here. There's a mountain of evidence on what transpired in terms of the government impropriety. This is an opportunity for the court to give more direction on Garcetti And in a case like Colleen's, you know, where it's not he said, she said, this is blatant evidence of deliberate misrepresentations to increase appropriations, right? It's an opportunity to protect that special value speech that whistleblowers like Colleen need,
right,
that protection. Otherwise, we are encouraging government corruption.
That's right.
And our hope is that the Supreme Court will appreciate that. Our hope is that the Supreme Court will also appreciate the misapplication of the summary judgment standard. Not only do we think that the Third Circuit got the First Amendment issue wrong, but in applying the summary judgment standard as well, where it seems as though the court has made the inferences go against the plaintiff whistleblower.
Right.
For reasons that we find hard to understand as lawyers. So that's what our real mission is in approaching the Supreme Court and being hopeful that because of the impact on Colleen, I think may have mentioned 30 million government workers, ultimately this whistleblower issue affects 10% of the population, right?
Yeah, right.
In the United States.
Right. So, you know, at the most kind of removed and kind of objective reasons, right, the Supreme Court would take this as a way of kind of looking at it to say, okay, we need some clarity of application, right?
Yes.
Clearly, there's people are struggling with trying to figure out how exactly we apply this standard, right? We do not want to be able to have kind of one set of standards in one part of the country, one set of standards in another part of the country. There should be clarity across the nation, right?
Yes.
That's the purpose of the Supreme Court,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
And on that side, we've got on that level.
Yes. And I would add to that the First Amendment whistleblower rights are really important because while we have some federal whistleblower protection, KITAM, and, you know, violations of federal law, we don't have a national whistleblower,
right,
standard. We have state laws that protect whistleblowers, but they're deficient in many instances. They're non-existent in some instances. And even in Colleen's case, Colleen got very sick as a result of what she was put through. She came down with two cases of shingles. She's got other serious inflammatory diseases that she's battling as a result of the stress that this case, this experience put her under. There's no recovery for that under Pennsylvania whistleblower law.
Right.
Right? But the First Amendment gives employees like that protections for other damages that they incur. Right. So this is an opportunity to really, really lay out in a clearer way what First Amendment rights whistleblowers have across the country.
Right. And this is exactly what I want to kind of get right at. So what, you know, we're looking at when people are looking at legal cases, especially when you're, you know, in cases that are dealing with, you know, bringing clarity to a kind of a particular reading of the law and things like this, people can get lost pretty quickly in terms of, like, you know, the abstraction of it.
Yes.
But in this case here, there's direct impact on every single person who'd be in this situation.
Yes.
Is that right now, it's like the way I look at it, how I characterize this right now, what's at stake in this case, in my mind, is this. If you take Garcetti on the one hand, right? So that gives us a guardrail on one side of your protection and the workplace. So that if you're doing this within your job, right, you do not have the First Amendment protection at this point.
Right.
Right? So that's a narrowing at that point. Right.
Yes.
Then currently we've got the other extreme where you've got the kind of, what was it, the Daugherty case, right?
Yes.
Where the guy goes outside of the workplace to the papers.
Yes.
Right. Clear. Okay. We've protected that. Right.
Yes.
So that is protected under that because he went kind of out here. If this case, if this is allowed to continue and Colleen's case is not, they're not to look at this and say, no, she has protection. What we're basically doing is bringing that other guardrail it back into the workplace and narrowing protections for whistleblowers to such a degree, right? It's effectively like completely discourages anybody from speaking up about cases of fraud and abuse moving forward.
Yes, and that's the danger. That's the harm. And interestingly, that Daugherty case is a Third Circuit case. And Daugherty is very similar factually to Colleen. In fact, I think Daugherty anticipated Colleen's case, but for some reason the Third Circuit has backed off at this point. But Daugherty involved a very senior level administrator of contracts with the Philadelphia school system. And the superintendent of schools allegedly misdirected or steered contracts inappropriately. Daugherty was responsible for contracts. In fact, the specific contract that was steered here was taken away from his responsibility. The superintendent appointed someone else to steer that contract, essentially, and Daugherty complained to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now, the parallels with Colleen's case is Daugherty clearly involved an area over which Daugherty had responsibility. The only factual difference is Daugherty took the more disruptive option of going to the Philadelphia right. Inquirer. They published a story on it. It created enormous disarray. In Colleen's case, unlike Daugherty, the budget fraud that took place here was an area over which she had responsibility, but she wasn't the one driving it.
No, it's right. not as if her responsibility was to create ways of like fraudulently reporting the budget.
Right.
Those were not her responsibilities, correct?
I mean,
that this is kind of, you know, the idea is like this baffles my mind because you think about it. It's like, of course, why you have whistleblower protections is precisely because if you are not involved with that situation, you don't know it's happening.
Right.
There has to be some sort of connection, right? And the only other option of that I can think of is like, okay, so what? You're a custodian at Westchester University, right? You're emptying out the recycling bin and notice a bunch of documents showing fraud, right? And then you report it. Then you get protection. That's the only thing that's left,
right?
You have to make sure that you don't balance your own checkbook too, because that might be kind of conflated with your own, you know, job thing. I mean, that's just insane to me. I mean, it's like this is kind of the design. This is the perfect case. And I tell you, you know, and you know this by now, that this I get worked up by this because we have been tracking this kind of abuse in the state system of higher education over and over again. The fact is that like it or not, like in this kind of in our world today, as a faculty member, as a union member coming forth and talking about this, your investment and your interests are always questioned. Like somehow, you know, you're just a special interest in here. And then, you know, you're only worried about yourself and you're reporting it. So everybody questions it. Right. When Colleen's case came out, right, for those of us who are in the system who have been trying to shine a light on this stuff and saying something is not right. Right. Her case gave all of us hope because we weren't crazy anymore.
Right.
Right. Because no. Right. Because everyone kept on telling us, no, you just don't understand budgets. You don't understand fiscal stuff. If you only understood these buckets of financial, I mean, we're like, whatever. Like, I'm looking at the stuff and I'm looking at Enron and Arthur Anderson kind of like level of abuse.
Right.
Right. And they're telling me, no, I just don't understand. Right. And I'm a guy who teaches writing and social media and things like this. Right. I'm not a budget guy. Right. So there's always that nagging doubt in the back of your head. And that is the case in every one of these situations. So it takes somebody to be able to recognize what the fraud is, what the abuse is, and then having the courage to say, I'm going to act in the public interest, even though this may have negative implications upon me. Right. Because there's bigger stakes here.
What you've just hit on is the special value speech that the Supreme Court values. Highest rung of protection. And here, for unknown reasons, the First Amendment protection just hasn't been there. Crazy.
This is incredible. I mean, so you have filing directly to the Supreme Court. When's this happen?
Well, let me actually back up a step.
Go ahead. Sorry.
We took an interim step. Mm-hmm. And filed a petition for rehearing en banc, which, given that we had laid out it very concisely in a 15-page document for the judges, the other judges of the Third Circuit, so there would be 11 that would actually rehear the case and see Colleen's supervisor's testimony and make a determination as to whether the three-judge panel erred. We needed a majority of judges to say, yes, this is worthy of rehearing en banc. And we just were notified a few weeks ago that they are declining to rehear the case. So at this point...
Did they give you a reason for this?
You don't get a reason.
You don't get a reason.
You just get a very short statement that says a majority of the judges do not wish to rehear the case. So that leaves as our last option at this point, filing the petition with the Supreme Court of the United States. And we feel that this case, the court doesn't take many cases. It's an uphill battle to get to the Supreme Court. But given the huge amount of government employees, taxpayers that are impacted by this decision, we think it's worthy. We think it's really worthy, and we hope that the court is going to have, you know, an interest in this unique opportunity to clarify Garcetti.
Yeah, and it's in a case that seems like built for this.
Yes.
I mean, built for this.
Yes.
You know, I just want to underscore for everybody out there, it's like, you know, exactly what Dan was just talking about. This hits everybody. Right. On the one hand, we're talking about the millions of government workers, right, that will be directly affected by this. We're talking about any student who's taken out a student loan in order to pay for their tuition as tuition prices and fees continue to rise. And you're kind of have to throw up your hands and say, well, I guess there's nothing that we can do because financial costs are out of control and the system is broke. Right. For faculty members who have lost their job and lost their tenure, right, precisely because the sky is falling budgets, right? If we are not going to protect whistleblowers who are willing to come out, right, not just for themselves and not for themselves. I mean, I don't know what Colleen gets out of this. I mean, Colleen, I look at, you know, we've talked a bunch now, and there's very little upside of this for you. Other than you can kind of live with yourself.
You hit it on the head. I mean, and people say, why would you put yourself through it? And my question is, how can you not do it? How can you not step up and tell your story because it's so wrong? And, you know, when you invest in yourself and you work really hard your entire life and you get, I call bullied, abused, and to think that I can walk away with this without any kind of peace in my mind, then I'm just going to be mentally sick the rest of my life. I mean, so from the standpoint of just feeling as though all I wanted is someone to explain how this could be right, and if this fixes the system 20%, 30%, 50%, it's more the whistleblower. Now, I have such a greater appreciation for whistleblowers and what you have to go through to actually tell your story. People would have to be insane to do this if my first protection right is violated here.
It's incredible. You know, I in cases like yours, and I've said this to you before, but the, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of think about people who have to make that kind of choice and the choice that you've made. And I personally, I always think down the road as, you know, at key points, I'm going to have decisions I have to make, right? And I'm going to have to at some point answer to my own kids, right? Be able to say when they say, hey, when this happened, what did you do, right? And that's the question that burns in my mind. That's the one that I would say that kind of keeps me on the path of telling the truth, even if it means that it's going to have negative implications for me personally, right? And I say I want to be able to tell my kids that, you know, when I saw what was wrong, I spoke out about it. Because I don't know how you live with yourself if your answer to that question is like, well, I just did what I was told.
You know, and it all comes down to leadership. I mean, change and change agents. I mean, you never think of yourself as that. And all, you know, from my perspective, it's always just about doing the right thing. We've talked about that. And to think a whole system that nobody's willing to step forward really is a sad state of affairs. And from that perspective, I just hope that by just the actions that we've, I mean, you figure this has been, it's 2018, this has been going on since you know, 2011, I started early. It's 2012. This has been continuing. It consumes your whole life. But at the end of the day, if it brings justice back to the system, then you know what? It's a slam dunk. And it's just something that you look back and you don't have regrets. If we wouldn't have done this, you live with regrets your entire life. And people handle that differently. But I that would have eaten me up.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I'm telling you, I want everybody, if you've taken the time to kind of listen today, I really appreciate you. Like I said, we're going to have lots of follow-up to this. We're going to have some more extended interviews about Colleen's case. Earlier today, because I'm down here meeting with Dan and Colleen now, earlier today we had Colleen tell her story, and you're all going to get to see that pretty soon too as well. We're going to be pushing this out because I think it's really important that you share this in every possible way. If you give like half a damn mm-hmm. about justice, about our democracy, and those values that we're supposed to hold dear, those ideas that, you know, that when an individual sees something wrong, they're supposed to stand up and they're supposed to kind of like do what's right. And we celebrate those people, right? Now is the time to stand behind and celebrate Colleen Bradley and make sure we get as many eyes on this as possible as this case goes forward. So, you know, I just can't thank both of you enough. I mean, for what you're doing. And Colleen, I know this has been it's a significant cost. But, I mean, it's inspiring. For what that's worth in the midst of it all, just to be, you know, to know that, okay, I'm not wrong about when I see people doing the right things, that is the right way to go. And I just hope that your story and your message resonates kind of across this nation. And then we get some kind of protections to ensure that people like you are going to be the ones that we stand behind.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, guys.
Any closing words for the good of the order for today?
The only thing I can say, I want to echo Colleen's sentiment around how difficult it is for a whistleblower to bring a federal claim, and you know that needs to change. And hopefully this case will be a step in that direction. Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate you got it. And we're going to be following you every step of this way. All right, so this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This has been a extra special Out the Coop Extra. Check out all the links that we're going to put down here in the show description. Follow back to learn what you can about Colleen Bradley's case. Look for additional material that is going to be coming out, both in terms of video form and some of the articles on Raging Chicken Press. And like I said, we are going to be following this case every step of the way, and we are going to doing our part in trying to bring this case to a much larger audience through the relationships that we've built over the years, because it is that important. It is that important that we stand behind Colleen Bradley at this point, to ensure that whistleblowers are protected and justice is done. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be talking to you soon. See ya!